105 UTC right after the international news.
As British Prime Minister Boris Johnson prepares to leave office soon, what does his departure mean for UK-Africa relations? From offensive remarks to the controversial UK-Rwanda deportation deal, and more African countries joining the British Commonwealth of Nations on his watch. What exactly does Johnson's record and legacy in Africa look like? We'll also discuss US-Africa trade relations as political and business leaders from African countries and the United States prepare to meet in Morocco for the US-Africa Business Summit.
We see the summit as a very important opportunity to bring together US and African government, as well as US and African private sector.
Straight Talk Africa starts now.
Hello there and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Heidi Adams. Thank you so much for joining me. The race is on to replace British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and there are now 8 hopefuls vying for the job. A new Prime Minister is expected to be announced on September 5th. The leadership debate was triggered last week when Johnson was forced to step down after a frenzy of more than 50 resignations from his government following a wave of scandals. Johnson played a decisive role in making Brexit happen. It was that initiative, the UK's split from the European Union, that helped propel him to Britain's highest office. But that was not what brought Johnson down. Critics point to his 3 turbulent years as Prime Minister as the straw that broke the camel's back. Johnson presided over office parties that broke COVID-19 lockdown rules that his own government designed.
I once again offer a full apology.
He also promoted an ally he knew had faced allegations of sexual misconduct. A scandal hit, chaotic premiership that cost Johnson what was once his greatest asset, his popularity with voters. On the streets of London, the mention of his name draws mixed reaction.
There's no sorry, no nothing. It's just like, come on, you know, pitiful. All he wanted to do was get to the pub. Sad, very sad.
Was he right to go, though?
God, yeah. I mean, it should have happened ages ago. In fact, he shouldn't have even been in Parliament. All I can say is it's all very pitiful, you know. We need someone charismatic who actually deals with the people on a people level. Do you know anyone who does that?
I'm a Labour supporter. But then, I love Boris. He's doing a lot for the country. And I wish that, you know, he could be forgiven to finish his tenure. He's trying to protect his cronies a lot. But then, you know, sometimes it doesn't work out like that. So, unfortunately, it's so sad. It's so sad, but, you know, there you go.
No, I think Boris should stay. I think he's a good guy, generally, and I think he's doing a good job. I think he should stay on.
I mean, he was pushed by all his MPs, but he was still hanging on. I don't know why, actually. It's shameful. It is. Europe is laughing at us, I'm sure.
He should have gone a long time ago. I'm sorry, because he's a complete incompetent. He's in it exactly for himself and no one else. Not the country. The lies he's portrayed, I'm glad he's gone, but it should have been a year ago.
I think the general public have had enough of him, really, his lies, this whole COVID situation about, you know, lying. People couldn't go to, you know, attend funerals. We think it was about time for him to go.
In Africa, Johnson leaves behind an equally mixed and controversial record. He made global headlines with his controversial immigration deal with Rwanda, which aims to send migrants and asylum seekers from the UK to the East African nation. Some will remember the offensive remarks Johnson made, especially during his time as British Foreign Secretary and Mayor of London, which sparked outrage across the African continent.
In a 2002 article on Congo, he referred to Africans as having, quote, watermelon smiles. In a column about Uganda in The Spectator, Johnson wrote, quote, the problem is not that we were in charge, but that we are not in charge anymore. He also called members of the British Commonwealth of Nations, quote, flag-waving pickaninnies. But on Johnson's watch, the British Commonwealth of Nations, a political association born out of the British Empire, expanded, especially in Africa.
Heads of government wish to formally send their congratulations to Her Majesty the Queen in the year of her Platinum Jubilee. And I am delighted to confirm that the Commonwealth she has served with such devotion will grow from 54 to 56 nations as we welcome the Gabonese Republic and the Togolese Republic into our family today.
The two French-speaking West African nations with no historical ties to Britain officially joined the club during the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting held in Rwanda's capital, Kigali, last month. In 2009, Rwanda joined the Commonwealth, which comprises 56 member countries with a combined population of 2.4 billion people. Well, joining me now to discuss Boris Johnson's legacy and how he has shaped the United Kingdom's relationship with African countries is David Monda. He is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He joins us from Johannesburg, South Africa today. And also with us from the United Kingdom is Nicholas Westcott. He's the director of the Royal African Society and a research associate at the Centre for International Studies and Diplomacy at the University of London. Gentlemen, what a great pleasure it is to have you both with me. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having
us. Well, David Monda, I want to kick things off here with you. The British Commonwealth of Nations has often been criticized as being out of touch, out of date, and largely ineffective. Now, I want to ask you, if that is the case, how come African countries keep joining the club? It seems to be expanding and not shrinking.
Well, I think critics of the Commonwealth have rightfully stated that a lot of the elements of the Commonwealth are out of touch and out of date, right? So, for instance, the whole issue of this special relationship or colonial legacies and ties between the former English-speaking colonies and the British, right? It's not what it used to be in the 50s or 60s. There's other powers like China, obviously the United States, Russia, that have come onto the stage. However, the broader issues of the core concepts of the Commonwealth Charter, I think, are important because they afford a lot of the Commonwealth nations, particularly the Anglophone nations, an alternate forum through which to have their issues and more broadly issues of the Global South heard. In addition to that, you have middle powers like New Zealand, Australia, and Canada, which can also bring their issues to the fore and press the UK, which has a permanent seat on the Security Council, to advance their issues. So I generally think, yes, there are elements of it which need to be revised, but I think in terms of multilateral framing of global issues and multilateralism, it's still very relevant, and this is why many countries still tend to join.
Nick, we don't often hear much about the Commonwealth. I mean, for those who are new to the conversation, can you give us a bit of background about what the UK is hoping to actually accomplish with this club?
There's no question that the Commonwealth had colonial origins, if you like, the Anglophone countries where the UK used to rule. And it was part of the transition process to try and retain good, strong links with the UK despite independence. And for many years that worked. It means there's a lot of close links through the universities, through the language, through the systems of law. So there is something that is substantively there. And the Commonwealth members themselves feel it's a good club to belong to. I took part in some of the Commonwealth meetings in Kigali recently. And it was quite clear the African members came because they wanted to meet the other African members in particular, but also India, as well as Australia, Canada, and the others. So it's a useful global club. It's Anglophone throughout, so people can understand each other, communicate very easily. And there are common interests. And the fact that it cuts across richer and poorer countries has real value. But what was most striking was that it has, if you like, its own existence now independent of Britain. And British views are less and less relevant. What matters is the collective view. And this time, African countries made their views very clear. Two new African members were admitted. And if you like, it's becoming a more African club.
David, there has been this long-running conversation on the continent and beyond about decolonization. So how does this idea of African countries then joining the British Commonwealth, how does that gel with this agenda of moving away from colonial powers culturally, economically, and even psychologically, which is a shift that there are many Africans who are aspiring to that?
I guess it's... It's a challenging dilemma to have. So, for example, if we think about cultural imperialism, right, it's generally an Anglophone club. So most of the members, are English speaking. A lot of the African countries then speak in English. But if English was not the common unifying language, then how would all these different African countries communicate? For example, South Africa in Hausa and Zulu versus Yoruba and Hausa in Nigeria versus Swahili and Kikuyu in Kenya versus Ewe and Ashanti in Ghana, right? So I think it's one of those areas that, that you have to take, a range or sort of a sampling of both the legacies of colonialism, but sort of making those legacies relevant to the common and current conditions. So I'm specifically thinking, for instance, around issues of common custom of English common law, right? And how that's then translated around the codification of human rights, around common issues of trade and limitations of trade barriers. When you speak one language, it's then a lot easier to communicate and facilitate other areas for exchange in education, and also in trade. So it's definitely a club formed from a colonial legacy. I just think it really needs to be modernized to become relevant. I think, and lastly, there really needs to be a re-emphasis in terms of how do we think about accentuating the values of the Charter, specifically on issues of valuing human rights and good governance. I'm not sure Togo, for example, and Gabon, right, the new entrants, and even Rwanda, which recently joined, right? A lot of the members have very suspect records in terms of valuing human rights, in terms of freedom of expression, and in terms of upholding good governance. So I think it's really a mixed bag in there.
And this was also an opportunity for journalists to ask Rwandan President Paul Kagame some questions about those who are in prison. And as he said, quote, no one is in prison in this country that shouldn't be there. So that was quite an interesting opportunity there as well. But Nick, I want to turn now to Boris Johnson himself. Now, he's a man who seldom leaves people wondering what he thinks about things and people. But, I'm going to ask you to be a bit of a mind reader here. From what you have observed, what exactly does Boris Johnson think of Africa? Does it differ from country to country for him? How does he perceive the continent, really?
Boris Johnson is one of the most energetic, optimistic, effervescent, you might say, leaders that Britain has ever had. And he made himself popular by telling people what they wanted to hear, whether it was true or not. And eventually he gets rumbled when it is not true. So in relation to Africa, his message was very upbeat, positive. Britain was going to become the biggest investor in the G7 in Africa. Trade was going to expand. Africa was to play a serious part on the world stage. But sadly, his actions rather belied this positive message. So he slashed aid, which is a very important component of Britain's relationship with African countries. He announced a tilt to Asia. Made it more difficult for Africans to get visas. And then there's the whole asylum scandal in relation to Rwanda. So his actions were seen in Africa as not very friendly. And this, therefore, has to some extent diminished Britain's standing in the continent, even though there is a great deal of continuing nostalgia. Nostalgia is not the right word. Affection for aspects of British life, the royal family, for the Premier League, for the British Council, for the education system. There's still fondness for that, but the government actions are not reinforcing it, they are undermining it.
David, I'm curious to know, what do you think Africans think about him? I mean, who likes him, who loathes him, and why?
I think for the most part, most Africans probably are struggling with daily, day-to-day issues, right? I mean, with COVID, with economic issues. But I think if you asked, if you asked the average African about the relationship with the UK, for example, in my country of origin, Kenya, I still think it's very much unclear about specifically what and where the UK is going to go. And I say that in this context. So there's a lot of internal dynamics within the UK, whether it's deciding what's going to happen post-Brexit, whether it's about whether the United Kingdom will remain the United Kingdom with issues of Scottish independence, broader issue of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And I think those internal dynamics complicate the UK's relationship with the continent, because it's not very clear whether the United States wants to maintain its close relations with the EU, whether it wants to maintain its transatlantic relationship to the United States and strengthen that special relationship, or whether it then wants to immerse itself further with emerging powers like China or developing countries like Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria, and the Bahamas. It's still not clear. And lastly, may I add to your earlier question about the character of Boris Johnson, I would equate him very much to, say, a Zuma here in South Africa, or a Donald Trump, a very populist sort of individual that thrives on this buffoonic sort of common man energy. Which really attracts him to the common man, because he's not a traditional politician. But I think that really clouds clear policy making. And I think this was a major issue when Boris Johnson came to power. He strived very much in terms of clearing a way to becoming prime minister. But when he actually became prime minister, you know, the haphazard nature of his governance and his policy making, and the absence of a clear agenda, particularly in terms of Africa, then becomes a problem. And this is where I think your question then ties in very clearly about where exactly does the UK go from here with Africa? And it's still not clear, particularly with the current crisis within the Conservative Party and British politics more broadly.
And I want to get back a little later on to British politics and what's going on at the moment. But Nick, given Johnson's offensive remarks that he's made in the direction of the African continent and its people in the past, has he really done anything to help change the perceptions there might be of Africa, negative perceptions in particular, inside the UK?
Johnson had a long career as a journalist before he went into politics. And in the course of that career, I think he insulted most countries under the sun. And these have been regularly dredged up. And he did say some appalling things, certainly about Africa. He restrained himself in office. This is something that I would...
We seem to have some technical problems there with Nick Westcott's connection. But David, I am going to continue with you here. Brexit is, of course, Johnson's signature initiative, and it was a very, very divisive issue in the UK and in Europe. It's been criticized as xenophobic, as being anti-immigrant, and of course that affects African immigrants. Has Brexit necessarily been bad for the business relationship between the UK and African countries?
I'd actually say Brexit has been positive for Africa, particularly if you think of the context of the fear of, you know, of a lot of the Commonwealth, that when, you know, when Great Britain, when the UK joined the EU in 73, right, that it was turning its back on, you know, on Africa, right? And as the integration got deeper and deeper, you know, there was a sense that, you know, the UK was abandoning its historical and customary and economic ties with the continent. But I think with the UK, you know, extricating itself from Brexit, I think this really creates multiple opportunities for the UK to re-engage with the continent, for the UK to re-engage with other partners outside of the EU. The challenge here, Heidi, is that it's not very clear, and Boris Johnson has not done a very good job about extricating the UK from Brexit. He said he'd get Brexit done, but it's just become even more complicated. And you know, we're probably going to get to this a little later. I think one of the more challenging issues, being here in South Africa, for example, and understanding Kenya and a lot of the African countries, is a lot of the migrants from the continent that really see the UK as one of those countries that they can seek asylum in and find safe haven. I think Boris Johnson has really reemphasized this xenophobia, and has really externalized the responsibility of the UK of catering to the depressed and those who are facing persecution. And I think this is a significant problem, particularly for a lot of people, not only on the continent, but more broadly, you know, in the former English Commonwealth, journalists, human rights activists, civil rights activists, to have to go to Rwanda before you go to the UK under very difficult circumstances is a problem. So Brexit has created its challenges, but I think more broadly it created a lot of opportunities. But therein also, in terms of the Brexit policy and the UK's migration policy, this has also become another challenge.
Indeed, there's the economic relationship, and then there's, of course, the human relationship. Nick, I just quickly want to move on. We don't have much time, but I want to take a look at the race to replace Johnson. It's, of course, in full swing. We now have 8 Conservatives vying for the job. Who do you think the front runners or the 2 front runners will be? And do you foresee a new prime minister making any drastic changes to either Brexit or UK-African relationships at large?
The 2 current front runners are Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss, and possibly there is an African candidate in Kemi Badenoch, who is getting more support than people had expected. But I don't believe it will make any difference for 2 reasons. One, this is the same Conservative Party. It comes from the same base. But secondly, Britain itself is changing, and Britain is, as a country, growing closer to Africa. And although Brexit, I agree, was all Little England a movement, it would cause great puzzles across Africa as to why on earth Britain would leave a club that everybody else wanted to join, and it caused some surprise in the UK. There is a very large African diaspora population here that keeps the country very closely linked to many African countries, and that is becoming a part of what Britain is and a part of British politics. So we can see this is the most ethnically diverse leadership competition there's ever been in a British party. And from India, from Africa, from Asia, those groups are now an integral part of British politics, and that includes the African group. So I would see relations in the long run continuing to get closer.
I want to ask you both very quickly. David, do you think we have seen the end of Boris Johnson? Is this the end of his political career? I mean, where else does he go from here? What do you think?
Well, in the tradition of British politics, right? So once you get out, it's very difficult to get back in. You think about the stoic career of Margaret Thatcher, you think of all John Major. Once you get kicked out, it tends to be a system where, as prime minister, you're a leader amongst equals, right? And if your party faction kicks you out, it becomes very challenging to get back in because, the leadership is taken over by others. So I tend to see him holding on. It's going to be a very interesting situation here in terms of, one, deciding who take over the leadership. But in the short term, deciding what exactly will be Boris Johnson's caretaker role, right, in sort of midwifing this transitional process. But I think politically, I see it very difficult for him coming back to be prime minister again. I think, and more broadly, the new leadership of the Conservative Party will continue to maintain the policies that have been there before. And I think the UK generally right now under the Conservative Party has been more inward-looking. And it's going to be interesting to see if Labour does win the next election, how British foreign policy, particularly in relation to Africa, will change.
Nick, we've got very little time here, less than a minute. What do you think? Is this the end of Boris Johnson, or will he be back?
David is right. He is politically dead, but like a bad penny, he will keep turning up. Boris loves the limelight. He will keep trying to hog it. But the question there is, the next election is almost certain to go to Labour. That will make a substantive difference. There will be different policies on immigration, different policies on relations with Africa. The only question is when that election will be.
Well, this has certainly been a very fascinating and at times entertaining conversation. Gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining me. David Monda is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He joined us from Johannesburg, South Africa. And Nicholas Westcott is in the UK. He is a research associate with the Center for International Studies and Diplomacy. He is also the director of the Royal African Society. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
We're going to take a short break here on Straight Talk Africa, and when we come back, we look at the business relationship between the United States and African countries. We'll bring you my interview with Flori Lazier of the Corporate Council on Africa. Stay with us.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linor Moudou, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
And you're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. Every year, the Corporate Council on Africa brings together political and business leaders from across Africa and the United States to discuss trade, investment, and commercial ties between the two regions. It's called the U.S.-Africa Business Summit. And this year, the summit takes place against a backdrop of a global economic crisis fueled by Russia's war in Ukraine. And even as some countries work to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, earlier I sat down with the CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa, Flori Lazier, to discuss the business relationship between African countries and the United States. Flori Lazier, CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
It's so great to have you here. Let's start out a little bit with some background. Tell us about the Corporate Council on Africa. What is it about? Why is it needed and what does it do?
So in 1993, a number of people in the private sector on the U.S. side thought that it was important to talk about the opportunities for investing in Africa, trading with Africa, doing business in Africa. And so we are almost 30 years old at this point. And I think the thing that's unique about Corporate Council on Africa is that we are a business association that is solely focused on Africa. And I tell people this is important because you can be a part of a larger organization where they have a division, that works on Africa, focuses on Africa. But Africa still may not be the sole focus for that organization. So the thing that's special about us is that Africa is what we are focused on. It is all we've ever been focused on, and it's all we're ever going to be focused on. And I think that's important, especially because in many cases, Africa does not get the kind of attention that it deserves, that's warranted. And especially in the business community, where Africa is now, I think, receiving only about 1.7% of all global FDI, it's important to shine a light on Africa, on the fact that the 54 countries of Africa is not one country, that if you see that there are things that may not be attractive in one African country, that doesn't mean that there aren't many other African countries that you can invest in and do business in. So CCA is committed to doing that. We also are committed to working with our African partners to talk about the doing business environment. What are the things that Africans can do that would make it easier, facilitate inward investment, facilitate doing business? And people say sometimes that, oh, it's so tough to do business in Africa. And I say, well, is it tougher than in other emerging markets in the world? How was it in China 35 years ago? How was it in the former Soviet republics, you know, 20 years ago? I think that the perception of doing business in Africa, the perception of risk in Africa, is actually not the reality. And I think that that is one of the things that Corporate Council on Africa is very determined to advocate about.
So when you talk to investors or potential or anyone who wants to do business in Africa, when you talk to them about that reality on the continent, what do you tell them about the trade and investment opportunities that exist for the United States in African countries right now? What makes investing in Africa appealing? What makes it profitable?
So, you know, the thing that's interesting, and I didn't mention this, but it's important, CCA has members that are both large and small multinationals, but also U.S. and Africans. And so we have a wide range of companies that are members that are doing business in the most promising and profitable sectors, the ones that are growing the fastest in Africa. So in health, health products and health services, and infrastructure, both hard and soft infrastructure, and ICT and the digital economy. We have many companies that are looking at that. We have companies that are into the security area, and people that are in finance, fintech. And so this is really important because one has to understand the breadth of opportunities that are there in Africa. So what do we say to people? Many of our companies have been there a long time. People say, where are the African companies? Where are the U.S. companies, Flory? Where are they in Africa? And I say, but they are here. You have companies like Procter & Gamble and Visa and Caterpillar that have been there for, you know, 50 years in some cases. But then you have some of our newer members, Amazon and Google, that have been there less time. And then you have companies that are in the health sector. We have a number of those, Pfizer and Gilead and Raven Martin and Johnson & Johnson. These are all Abbott. These are all companies where the opportunities in Africa also shift, right? So over time, we've seen that there are companies that are focused on, in that sector, developing the right responses to malaria. Now there's a malaria vaccine, or the right responses to Ebola, or more recently, of course, the right responses, the needed responses to the COVID pandemic. And so companies like Pfizer, like Johnson & Johnson, who maybe, what, 3 or 4 years ago, pre-COVID, would not necessarily have thought about producing certain kinds of vaccines, mRNA vaccines, in Africa are now doing that. So what I think is most important for people to know is that Africa provides lots of opportunities in various sectors, and it's always evolving. It's always evolving.
So what's always made Africa, or at least in the perception or the minds of many people across the continent, is that Africa's most attractive feature, of course, is its extractive industries. As some African countries themselves work to diversify, what investment opportunities are there on the continent that go beyond the extractive industries? Some examples that you could share with us.
So, you know, we should start from the big picture. Africa today, and this is actually shocking, accounts for only 3% of all global trade. Actually, it's a little less than 3%. Now, I remember when it accounted for about 2% of world trade. And there was a study that came out that said if Africa was able to capture just one additional percentage of global trade, that would have been equivalent to three times the amount of development assistance that Africa gets from everyone in the world, which shows you the power of trade and investment. It shows you that if you trade, if you invest, if you create jobs, that actually is far more impactful, has more of an impact than development assistance. And I'm a big supporter of development assistance, humanitarian aid. And there are going to be lots of situations and in various countries where they will need that. So I'm not advocating against development assistance. However, I am advocating for the importance of Africa being able to participate more fully in the global economy, to be able to be active partners in regional and global value chains. And I'll use an example of this. You asked about commodities. So most of the reason that Africa accounts for only 3% of world trade today is because it is shipping commodities that are raw and have not been processed. No value addition or beneficiation, as the Africans would say. So take, for example, Africa's cashews. Almost 70% of Africa's cashews are shipped out of the continent to South Asia, largely to Vietnam and India, for processing. Those cashews that are processed in, for example, Vietnam, that's an entire industry that's been developed there that needs and depends on Africa's raw cashews. So we're advocating for, and when I was in government, in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, constantly advocating for the kind of value addition and processing of Africa's own commodities on the continent of Africa. Let's invest in those sectors there. Let's develop and create the jobs there. And then let's see how that will, in fact, contribute to Africa being able to capture more of global trade. And if you look at so many products that Africa has, whether it's their diamonds, most of their diamonds are cut and polished elsewhere. Coffee, most of their coffee is roasted and brewed elsewhere, you know, et cetera. And you can take almost every value chain, copper, iron, even petroleum. When you look at oil, crude oil, right, and then they're importing back in mostly the manufactured products which use their inputs and their raw commodities. So the key for Africa to be able to really build its economy and use trade and investment as an engine for economic growth, which is what everybody else in the world has done, is really to be able to get more manufacturing and industrialization and value addition of its own commodities. And I think we're starting to see that happening more now.
And the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement, a lot of it is about that, to see finished goods actually leave the African continent. And I want to get to that a little later on. Mm-hmm. You know, what is the state, Florrie, of the business relationship right now between the African continent and the United States?
Well, see, because we get to talk to businesses, even the ones that have been there a while, but maybe they're only in 5 or 6 countries, and now they're looking to expand into other countries. Maybe they've been in one sector and are looking to expand into other sectors. And so what we hear is that there are a lot of opportunities, but being able to actually move in and settle the agreements, the commercial agreements that have to be done, getting the licenses from government for operating in those countries, whatever it is that you need to do business in those countries, to expand into a new sector, to hire people, that some of those processes take either too long or are inefficient. And so as a result, you hear sometimes some frustration from businesses that say, you know, they want to move at, you know, 80 miles an hour, and they're only able to move at, you know, 50 miles an hour. But I think that what we say to people is you have to have patience. You can't just, you know, pop in and think that you're going to, you know, come and sit down, negotiate a deal, and be out of there in a week. So patience is important. Presence is important. People need to see you there. It's not, especially in Africa where relationships are so important, you can't just come once a year, meet with all the key people, and think that you can build the kinds of business relationships that are going to be beneficial for both sides, mutually beneficial.
And that's part of the culture of doing business,
exactly.
Right? Like you would in Asian countries as well. There is a certain cultural protocol to follow when doing business.
Right, right. But being present in Africa is important, and we are finding that many of our member companies of CCA and others more generally realize that they need to have people on the ground, boots on the ground, as they say, and for them to be able to also develop the kinds of relationships that are important. And this is something that I think that CCA does well. We provide the kinds of access and connections that are important. So, you know, when a minister of finance is coming to the U.S., or a head of state is coming to the U.S., or the head of the Africa CDC is coming to the U.S., what we're trying to do is to make sure that our members have an opportunity to meet with them, to find out what's going on. And so I'm really pleased that we're able to do that. We weren't able to do it in person for, what, more than 2 years. And then we started off small again last fall during the UN General Assembly. We hosted the president of Namibia. We hosted the president of the African Development Bank. We hosted the president of Tanzania, the only female head of state in Africa. And we started having smaller meetings. Maybe we could only have, you know, 35 or 45 people in the room, but that is so important.
The face-to-face.
Yes.
Contact. You talked about existing relationships or building these relationships. What about the relationships that exist and the agreements that exist between African countries? Now with the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement or Free Trade Zone in place, which is aimed at a more unified African market, how are those relationships impacted,
right?
Those individual relationships countries might have with the United States.
Right. So I think the first thing to talk about, though, with the AFCFTA is the fact that it is a game changer for Africans in terms of how they deal with each other, opening up their borders, reducing barriers to trade, the free movement of goods and people and resources across 54 countries. And for a lot of Americans and other business people around the world, many of those economies are so small individually that how do they attract the kind of investment that they need? So the AFCFTA, by pulling together some of the regional economic communities, whether it's in East Africa or West Africa or Southern Africa now, they have a continental-wide market, and 1.3 billion people, and it's going to be worth trillions of dollars in terms of that market. So now if you wanted to invest in East Africa, and you couldn't decide kind of where you were going to go, you could go to Tanzania and know that you'll have access to Kenya and, you know, other countries, Rwanda in East Africa. But now you also have the opportunity to say, okay, I'm planning to expand my digital business, my ICT business. I'm going to invest in Rwanda, and I'm going to use that as my base to actually expand into other parts of Africa altogether, out of East Africa. And so I think that the AfCFTA is important not just for opening up trade and investment amongst Africans, but for making them more attractive as a continental market for businesses that want to invest there.
We touched earlier on foreign direct investment flows. They've been decreasing in recent years. They've fallen as it flows to developing countries, especially to African countries. And given the economic crises we see in the world right now, what does the future look like in terms of foreign direct investment going to Africa? Do you expect some of that will stagnate, at least in the short term? Do you see an increase, or do you see a continued decline?
So, you know, I think that it's not a one-size-fits-all answer, because I'm not so sure that FDI has been falling in all sectors in Africa. In fact, I think there's some sectors, say, for example, fintech. I read something that said that there were an enormous amount of investments, new greenfield investments into the fintech sector in Africa last year and the year before. Now, some of that is partly driven by the fact that all of us had to be more virtual, and there are all these new technologies. And, you know, 3 years ago, you know, there was Zoom, but now, you know, we couldn't live without it. We wouldn't have made it without those kinds of platforms, not just that one. So what I would say is, first, let's check the numbers and let's make sure we're clear which sectors are growing, which sectors are attracting FDI, and which are not. I would say the health sector is another one that's been expanding. Correct. And where, you know, we saw certain value chains that broke down. And so, you know, are we able to now have Africa producing some of those products, not just vaccines, but the PPEs and ventilators and all of that. And I think that there will be more of those kinds of things happening. For example, semiconductors. We understand that, you know, many factories around the world, here in the U.S., there are auto factories that had to shut down for a while because they couldn't get access to semiconductors. Mm-hmm. Batteries for electric vehicles, right, EVs. These are all areas where I think the opportunities are ripe to go into Africa, invest in producing those products there. They have all of these strategic minerals that are needed, you know, for certain technologies and certain businesses. You know, why not produce the batteries there in Africa? It's closer. It should be less expensive. And even where the productivity levels may not be as high, if you bring the right technologies to Africa, we've seen this. And Africa is, by the way, developing its own technologies in a number of these areas, not like they are sitting there begging for everybody else's technologies. The first time I saw mobile banking was, frankly, on the continent.
Yeah.
Right? People were doing that in Africa when I was traveling there all the time before we were doing it here in the U.S.
And so many cases, necessity has helped Africa leapfrog.
Exactly.
Many of these technologies. So what are we talked about the advantages for the United States in Africa. What are the advantages for African countries of doing business with the United States, especially when there today are other options for Africans?
Absolutely. So, you know, there hasn't been any place that I've traveled to in Africa, and I've been to a lot of the countries, where people don't essentially look to having business partnerships with American companies, and I think there are reasons for that. It's not that they can't do business with other with companies from other countries. They can do business with Chinese companies. They can do business with French companies, Indian companies. But what they like about the American companies is that we will bring certain ways that we do business. There's more technology transfer. We tend to be more open in terms of partnering and utilizing people there on the ground. Not everybody does that. So we come in and we have a tendency to transfer skills, transfer technology, and work closely with them. Also, I think people recognize that we have certain products here in the U.S. that are valued in a particular kind of way. And people want to be able to partner with companies who have those kinds of high-quality products. Not to talk about anyone else, but, you know, if you buy this product from an American company, it will last, a decade. If you buy that same a piece of equipment from other countries, it may only last 3 or 4 years. So there's a value to working with the Americans, but it's not just the value of our products, it's also the value of the partnerships, the way that we work with folks. And then, not to leave it out, it's also important that American companies have to operate in Africa as they do in the rest of the world, with certain things related to corruption and so forth. So they also bring to the table sort of the best practices and standards for how businesses should cooperate and work with each other.
Do those come as strings attached?
I think they come more as this is the value of working with an American company. You don't have to worry about this or that. You know that it's not going to come to light later on that there's something, inappropriate that's been happening that's going to either endanger you and your business or endanger the American company and their business. And I think people appreciate that. I think folks want straightforward, issue-free, corruption-free opportunities and partnerships. And I do think that American companies in particular do offer that. They may not be the only ones in the world who do, but I think that we are known for being able to offer those kinds of business partnerships, and Africans want those kinds of partnerships.
This year we have the U.S.-Africa Business Summit, as you have every year. I think there was a year during the pandemic that you didn't have it. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit more about this year's U.S.-Africa Business Summit. It sounds very exciting, and I want you to give us some of the details.
Well, first of all, we had planned to hold the U.S.-Africa Business Summit in 2020 in Morocco. It would have been our first business summit in North Africa, but the pattern had been that we would hold the, it was first of all, it used to be biannual, and we would meet here in the U.S., and then 2 years later, we would meet in Africa, and then we'd come back to the U.S. But what that meant was that we were only doing the summit in Africa every 4 years. And there was a lot of demand. We had countries that were coming to us and saying, well, why can't we host the summit next year in our country? And so the board of directors decided back in 2018 that we would have the summit every year annually, and that way every other year we would be on the continent. And that seems to be just about where the demand would be. And so we had the last summit in Africa was in Maputo. And then we couldn't go to Morocco. And this past year, we had a virtual summit. And it was actually quite successful. We had 6 African heads of state, 5 members of the Biden administration, cabinet members of the Biden administration that joined us, and probably about 1,800 people that joined us, CEOs and executives from across the continent and the U.S. So now we're going back to in-person, and we are so excited about it. This is the 14th U.S.-Africa Business Summit. It will be in Marrakesh, Morocco, on July 19th to the 22nd. We invite everyone to come. It will have and host some African heads of state. We are honored that our co-host, the government of Morocco, We learned maybe about just 10 days ago that the summit will be under the high patronage of King Mohammed VI. Such an honor, because that means they are giving it the highest level of attention for an event in their country, and they host many events. So we are partnering with the Moroccan government. We have any number of senior people from Morocco that are joining us. But we also have lots and lots of companies, both CCA member companies as well as non-member companies, and who are learning about us and saying, oh, wait, I should be there. Maybe I'll become a member of CCA, who will be joining us. Our theme is Building Forward Together. And we are really excited about that theme, because I think at this point in time, both coming out of COVID, hopefully we're all coming out, but also there's a lot of pent-up demand for in-person meetings. And then this is also a time where Africans are also dealing with now the Russia-Ukraine crisis, and that's having an impact on them, on the economies in Africa. So, you know, sort of double, triple whammies that have happened. So this is a very important time, and we see the summit as a very important opportunity to bring together U.S. and African government, as well as U.S. and African private sector. And I just have to say something. We are really delighted. We have an incredible U.S. government delegation that will be led by the CEO of the Millennium Challenge Corporation, MCC. Alice Albright is leading this delegation. We learned that from the White House last week. And we have key people from so many U.S. government agencies that are involved in U.S.-Africa trade and business. And if I start naming them, I'll probably
forget someone
and offend. But let me just say that all the key agencies that are working on Africa in one way or another are going to be represented at the U.S.-Africa Business Summit. We're excited about that. And again, we are really pleased to co-host this with the Moroccan government. President Akufo Addo of Ghana is coming. President Masisi of Botswana is coming. And we have a few others that are still in the works, even though the date is coming up soon. But we think that'll happen. We also have the head of the African Development Bank, who will be joining us, the head of UNECA, the UN Economic Commission for Africa, who will be there, the head of the Trade and Development Bank. So, you know, there's so many folks who are going to be there. Oh, and we were talking about AFCFTA. We have the Secretary General who will be joining us from AFCFTA.
Juan Kelemene. So we had him here on the show, too. This was this looks like quite the lineup. And anyone who was thinking of not showing up, now that you've mentioned their names on television, they have to show up, although you'll have no trouble getting people to Morocco for your event. Thank you so much. This was very enlightening. And we really hope to have you back on our show again in future. Flory Lazier, the CEO of the Corporate Council on Africa. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And that is our show this week. Thank you to all my guests for joining me. Thanks to all our affiliate stations airing Straight Talk Africa across the African continent. And of course, a big thank you to you, our audience, for joining me on television, radio, and online. Thank you for always watching and always listening. Until next time, go well. Goodbye.
from around the world. Let's go.